Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are diving deep today into a stack of really challenging historical sources, specifically analytical material that's been derived from extensive research and discussions around the earliest revelations of Joseph Smith.
And our mission today is pretty direct.
It is. We want to provide you, the learner, with a kind of shortcut, a really efficient and thorough way to understand the persistent patterns that are woven all through this material.
We're focusing on what's known as the Doctrine and Covenants, or the DNC. It contains many of these foundational communications, along with other prophetic claims made by Smith.
And we're really trying to resolve a fundamental analytical question here.
Right. When you look at the historical context, the circumstances surrounding these documents, do they look primarily, top down?
Meaning unambiguous commands from an omnipotent, eternal deity.
Exactly. Or are they bottom up? Are they pragmatic, immediate, and, well, often self-serving solutions to Joseph Smith's pressing financial needs, his personal desires, or maybe a leadership crisis he was facing at that moment?
And that distinction, divine decree versus practical convenience, it's everything in this discussion. We're specifically looking for those aha moments that really highlight where these revelations seem to function as a form of leverage.
It's a fascinating and, frankly, a crucial area of historical analysis. Because if you can isolate that pattern of convenience, it really changes how you view the nature of the entire prophetic process.
And that pattern begins very early on.
Oh, yeah. Let's unpack the first major theme, which is the use of revelation to secure financial and material gains. This starts right from the very beginning of the movement, essentially weaponizing the voice of God as a kind of collection mechanism.
And we have to start with what is maybe the highest stakes fundraising campaign in early American religious history, getting the money to print the Book of Mormon, which brings us straight to Martin Harris.
Harris was absolutely essential. He was a relatively prosperous farmer, a landowner in Palmyra, New York. Joseph Smith had the manuscript, but he needed something like $3,000 for the printing.
Which was an astronomical sum for the 1820s.
A fortune. And Harris was hesitant to mortgage his farm to get it. His reluctance was definitely amplified by his wife, Lucy Harris, who was deeply, deeply skeptical.
And Lucy Harris was a formidable opponent to this whole new faith. She famously demanded to see the plates, and when she was denied, she became, well, furious.
She was. She even demanded proof of the translation later, which is what led to that whole 116 lost pages crisis we'll get into. She wasn't just skeptical. She was actively campaigning against Martin's investment.
So the pressure on Martin must have been immense. Finance this thing and risk financial ruin and the collapse of your marriage, or refuse and risk this whole spiritual project is falling apart.
So given this critical bottleneck, Joseph Smith could have pleaded with him, or maybe offered him a partnership agreement. But instead, he receives a revelation, DNC Section 19, and it's directed explicitly at Martin.
And this is not a request.
Not at all. It's a divine, fear-inducing command. The stakes are escalated immediately. The revelation starts by talking about eternal punishment, which is just a powerful psychological lever to use on a deeply religious man who's already struggling with his conscience and all this opposition at home.
The language is intense.
Listen to this. It's targeting Harris's fear of the afterlife. It reads, "Repent, lest I smite you by the rod of my mouth, and by my wrath, and by my anger in your sufferings. Be sore, how sore, you know not, how exquisite, you know not, yea, how hard to bear, you know not."
Wow. It's just an escalating, terrifying description of suffering. It's tailored to overwhelm any earthly concern, like losing a farm.
It's highly effective psychological torture, really, but it's dressed up as scripture. And then the command shifts from that eternal threat to an immediate financial instruction.
Right to the point.
The document then explicitly commands him, "I command thee, thou, that thou shalt not covet thine own property, but import it freely to the printing of the Book of Mormon."
So the choice is just eliminated.
Completely. By using the voice of God, Joseph Smith basically took away Martin Harris's free will to decide and replaced it with a divine obligation.
And the result speaks for itself. I mean, it tells you everything you need to know about how effective this tactic was.
Martin Harris immediately mortgaged his farm. He secured the funds. And looking at this analytically, this moment is a textbook example of leverage. Joseph Smith needed money, and he used his unique authority to manifest the voice of God, which was infinitely more persuasive than just asking for a loan.
And you mentioned this tactic connects back to something even earlier in his life, his foundational superpower, which he honed long before the Book of Mormon was ever printed.
Right, his years as a hired treasure seeker.
Let's spend a moment on that parallel, because the source material really highlights this as a profound moment of, well, learned manipulation. Before he was a prophet, he was paid to use a seer stone to find buried treasure.
That's right. And the crucial insight here is that Joseph Smith never actually found any treasure. Not once. The digs always failed. Yet the source material indicates that people consistently paid him. And this is the important part. They often left those failed digs still believing in his ability, still convinced he had this spiritual authority. He was incredibly skilled at using charisma and prophetic claims to manage failure.
So he learned that the claim of spiritual authority, even if it didn't produce physical results, was enough to secure compliance and resources from people.
The threat in DNC 19 is just the spiritual evolution of that learned behavior. He swapped a simple dowsing rod for the Doctrine and Covenants. Now, his authority wasn't just to find gold. It was to determine eternal salvation or damnation.
It was the ultimate infallible leverage.
And this pattern, this divine financial specificity, it continues long after the Book of Mormon is printed. We see the voice of God intervening later on, not just to fund the church, but to fund specific real estate projects that benefited Joseph Smith directly.
Which brings us to the Nauvoo House. This is all detailed in DNC 124.
Right. By the time they're in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith is no longer a humble farmer. He is the head of a massive, thriving, though politically troubled community. And he wanted to fund the Nauvoo House. It was advertised as this massive hotel for visiting dignitaries and saints.
But it also functioned as the Nauvoo Mansion House, a pretty luxurious residence for Joseph and Emma.
Exactly. And what's so astonishing about DNC 124 is the incredible, almost bureaucratic level of detail that the supposed creator of the universe provides.
It's fascinating. An omnipotent God, the source of all celestial law, intervenes to dictate these granular earthly stock instructions.
The revelation commands that shares must not be less than $50 for a share of stock. And, maybe even more bizarrely, it limits a total investment from any single person to $15,000 from any one man.
Okay, let's just pause on that for a second. Why is the eternal God, the being who set the stars in motion, so concerned with the denomination and ceiling of stock purchases for one specific temporary building in Illinois in 1841?
It immediately raises a question about priority, doesn't it?
It absolutely begs the question. If this is truly a top-down communication, why is the content so hyper-specific and mundane? The source material highlights this sharp contrast. God is silent on massive eternal questions.
Right, like the church's eventual massive financial dealings or complex modern crises.
Yet he's meticulously involved in the $50 stock shares of a hotel. This level of detail just screams bottom-up convenience.
And on top of that, the credibility of this revelation is undermined even further because this same section of the DNC is a mix of these business instructions and a failed prophecy, which suggests it was written to settle some scores.
What was the failed prophecy?
DNC 124 tries to wrap the financial instructions in this mantle of prophetic authority by including a threat against old enemies. God claimed to have a scourge prepared for the inhabitants of Kirtland, the place the saints had just been driven out of.
That is a very convenient prophecy to receive right after you've been chased out of town.
Of course. It gave Joseph a moment of divine vindication against his persecutors.
But the scourge never happened.
Never materialized. Kirtland continued as a functioning town. So within the same document, you have one, highly detailed temporary financial instructions that benefit Joseph. Two, a failed prophecy designed to avenge his enemies. And three, the document itself acts as a massive collection effort.
When a revelation is this specific, this personally beneficial, and this flawed, it fundamentally alters its credibility as a divine word.
It looks exactly like a human leader using spiritual authority to manage his cash flow and his political grievances.
And that distinction, hyper-specific benefit versus broad eternal truth, is so critical. If we accept this pattern of using revelation for financial necessity, it's a strong transition point to the most troubling application of this leverage, using revelation to override the moral conscience of others.
That's right. When Joseph Smith moves from using the voice of God for money to using it for personal, sexual, and marital control, the leverage becomes absolute and far, far more intense.
This is where we see the ultimate form of leverage, when revelations are used to establish a new principle, in this case, plural marriage or polygamy, that fundamentally contradicted the societal and religious morality of the time. This required absolute coercion.
The source material is very clear that Joseph Smith quickly ran into significant resistance when he approached women directly.
I can imagine.
If he simply asked, they were prone to, and this is a quote, shriek at you, slap you, and walk away, which is a perfect description of how most 19th century American women would react to a proposition for plural marriage.
So he needed a tool powerful enough to overcome that immediate physical and moral resistance.
And that tool was the threat of God's wrath. Which brings us to the famous, or maybe infamous, angel with a drawn sword narrative.
This was his go-to story, wasn't it? Used to secure compliance, claiming that God was threatening his life if he didn't establish the principle.
And we should look closely at the case of Zena Huntington. Zena Huntington was already married to a man named Henry Jacob when Joseph Smith approached her. She was not a willing participant. She had initially rejected his earlier proposal. So to overcome this, Joseph deployed the highest possible threat to secure her as a plural wife.
And Zena herself recounted the experience. She noted that Joseph Smith sent the word by her brother. The message was explicit,
claiming Joseph put it off and put it off till an angel with a drawn sword stood by me and told me if I did not establish that principle upon the earth, I would lose my position and my life.
So what's crucial here is the analysis from the source material, which points to a major contradiction in the timeline. We have to ask, was this threat real or was it a calculated lie?
If we look at the historical record, this event happened after Joseph Smith had already taken several plural wives. Zena Huntington, by most historical estimates, was his fourth plural wife.
A fourth, okay.
Exactly. So if the angel was commanding him to establish that principle upon the earth, and she was the fourth wife, the principle was already established.
That's a damning inconsistency.
Yeah,
it is. It strongly suggests the purpose of the threat wasn't to start polygamy, but specifically to overcome Zena's personal established resistance and to secure her. The narrative shifts from a divine mandate for the whole church to a highly effective intimidation tactic against one woman.
It takes the power dynamics from theological to transactional. It's no longer about establishing a law. It's about conquering resistance.
And we see the same coercive dynamic, perhaps even more heartbreakingly, in the account of Lucy Walker.
Lucy Walker's situation was one of just profound vulnerability.
She was only 17 years old. Her mother had recently died, and her father, who was a supporter of Joseph Smith, had been sent away on a mission. This left Lucy in the care of the Smith household.
An absolute position of dependency.
Total dependency. And in that situation, Joseph presented her with a direct proposal that was framed entirely as a divine command, leaving her with absolutely no social or religious space to refuse.
Her response is so telling. She called the announcement a thunderbolt.
That phrase just encapsulates the shock and the internal conflict she must have felt. Yet, when she was asked if she believed Joseph was a prophet, she said, and I'm quoting, "Most assuredly, I do."
And that quote is the key. That's the key to understanding the leverage. She had clear personal reluctance, the thunderbolt reaction, but her faith in his prophetic authority was absolute.
She wasn't yielding to Joseph Smith, the man. She was submitting to the authority of God. Her personal conscience was made irrelevant because the request had been placed beyond human debate.
This is spiritual coercion perfected. It uses absolute faith to circumvent free will and moral boundaries.
And this system of coercive leverage, it reaches its absolute zenith when Joseph Smith uses revelation to try and control his own wife, Emma.
Which brings us to the formal canonization of the Principle, Doctrine, and Covenants, section 132. This revelation was dictated in 1843, not at the beginning of the practice, but as a crisis management tool.
The context is crucial. Joseph had been practicing polygamy in secret. Emma Smith discovered it, or at least the extent of it, and she was, very understandably, absolutely furious, and she threatened to expose him.
So Joseph needed a nuclear option to restore order and force her to comply.
That nuclear option was DNC 132. The source material notes that Joseph dictated this revelation. It's a massive 3,200-word document. In one single sitting, with the explicit, confirmed intent of having his brother, Hiram, deliver it to Emma to silence her resistance.
And the content confirms that the intent was coercion.
This document does not mince words. It explicitly threatens Emma with destruction, that she would be destroyed if she did not abide in this covenant. And that threat, according to analysis of the source material, is repeated 6 different times within the document.
It's not theology. It's an ultimatum backed by divine damnation.
It's stark. It lacks any of the gentle persuasion or theological comfort you might expect from a loving God revealing a challenging new principle to one of the most important women in the faith. It is a purely punitive document aimed at maintaining Joseph's personal life and his power structure.
And this brings us to the ethical and structural critique of the system itself. You know, the source material makes a comparison to secular governance structures like the U.S. Constitution, which relies on checks and balances.
Right. Executive, legislative, judicial, all to prevent the consolidation of power and the subsequent abuse.
So if God is a God of infinite wisdom, why would his chosen method of governance on Earth, prophetic revelation, establish a system entirely devoid of checks and balances?
This is the critical flaw. Joseph Smith is the sole channel for the revelation, and that revelation invariably serves his own interests. His financial interests, his leadership monopoly, and in this case, his sexual interests.
If God were truly wise and impartial, the message of DNC 132 should have been delivered directly to the women involved, or maybe via a neutral party.
An angel without a sword, perhaps?
Exactly. The system, where the prophet benefits and is the only channel, is structurally designed for the abuse of power. When the prophet's personal desires are simultaneously enshrined as God's eternal law, the claim of top-down divinity begins to crumble under the weight of just sheer, overwhelming self-interest.
Which leads us seamlessly to our next major pattern, the revelations of convenience. These are not about establishing grand eternal principles, but simply about getting Joseph Smith out of an immediate mundane jam or covering a massive credibility gap.
Right. So if the previous segment showed financial and coercive leverage, this segment is about intellectual and operational leverage. And we have to begin with maybe the most famous translational crisis of all, the loss of the 116 pages.
This crisis was potentially fatal to Joseph Smith's claims.
Yeah.
Martin Harris, pressured by his skeptical wife, Lucy, convinced Joseph to let him borrow the first 116 translated pages of the Book of Mormon manuscript.
And Harris promptly lost them.
He lost them. The problem this posed for Joseph was enormous. He couldn't just retranslate the lost portion.
Why not?
Because if he retranslated the material, any slight difference, any change in wording, phrasing, or narrative from the lost pages, which Lucy Harris might still have had a copy of, it would immediately expose him as the author. The retranslation had to be verbatim, which is nearly impossible, or he'd be exposed as a fraud.
He needed a theological escape hatch, and he needed it immediately.
The solution was DNC Section 10. And this revelation is a textbook example of theological damage control. It shifts the narrative from Joseph lost the manuscript to God already planned for this test of faith.
So God suddenly reveals that this loss was foreseen and preordained from the very beginning.
It was all part of a master plan, conveniently conceived just when Joseph needed an excuse. The official rationale given in the revelation is almost comically convoluted. It warns that evil people would prove him a fraud by altering his pages if he retranslated the original part.
So to prevent evil people from changing the text, God commanded him not to translate it again.
Exactly. Instead, he was instructed to translate from the small plates of Nephi, which covered the same period, but provided a new, separate historical account.
It's brilliant, frankly, from a psychological manipulation standpoint. It turned a catastrophic failure, losing sacred scripture, into a vindication of his prophetic foresight.
It bought him time. It solved his immediate crisis. And it created a new narrative to explain the massive gap in the final Book of Mormon text.
And this pattern of using revelation to crush internal challenges to authority is seen even more clearly when his own scribe, Oliver Cowdery, wanted to try his hand at revelation.
Oliver Cowdery was essential to the early project. He was empowered by the spiritual excitement of the day, and he felt he, too, could translate and receive divine guidance. He was reportedly using his dowsing rod.
A divining rod.
Yes. Which was later codified in early editions of the DNC as the gift of Aaron. So Oliver tried, and he failed.
And that failure was a big problem for Joseph.
Huge problem. Because if his closest collaborator could receive revelation but couldn't translate, it undermined Oliver's support and raised questions about what made Joseph so special. He had to reinforce his monopoly. And this resulted in DNC Section 9, which is often called the Great Oliver Cowdery Smackdown.
And this revelation is a masterful piece of blame reversal, or what we might call gaslighting today. It attributes Oliver's failure entirely to his own shortcomings. It makes Oliver feel guilty for not being a proper prophet.
The revelation claims Oliver has not understood, and that he supposed God would just give him the translation when you took no thought save it was to ask me. The blame is completely shifted from the process to the participant.
And crucially, Joseph established a new, impossibly vague rule for successful translation, one that only he could verify.
And that's the burning in the bosom criterion. Joseph told Oliver that successful revelation requires that you must study it out in your mind. Then you must ask me if it be right, and if it is right, I will cause that your bosom shall burn within you.
Which creates a closed loop.
A completely closed loop. Only Joseph Smith, the ultimate arbiter, could determine whether the burning was truly divine or just Satan deceiving you. It secured his monopoly on interpretation.
And then, as a placation prize to keep Oliver loyal, the revelation offers a future carrot.
It does. It promises, "Other records have I, that I will give unto you power that you may assist to translate later on." This keeps Oliver invested in the system and ensures he remains an assistant, not a rival.
So if Oliver was a challenge from within the partnership, Hiram Page was an external threat that needed to be neutralized even more urgently.
Right, because he challenged Joseph's methods directly. Hiram Page got his own seer stone, the exact same tool Joseph used, and started receiving revelations.
And here's the frightening part for Joseph. Page's revelations were believed by two of the three main Book of Mormon witnesses, Oliver Cowdery and David Whitmer.
This was an existential threat. If someone else could use the same prophetic methods and convince two of your key witnesses that their results were legitimate, your unique role is destroyed. The question became, why are Joseph's revelations divine and Hiram's are not, if the method is identical?
The answer came immediately via DNC Section 28, a pure revelation of convenience designed to establish a prophetic monopoly.
The decree is unmistakable and absolute. No one shall be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church except my servant Joseph Smith, Jr. This revelation instantly solidified a single, exclusive channel for all divine communication.
But the takedown of Page is the most pragmatic part.
It is. Joseph is commanded to tell Hiram Page that his revelations are not of me and that Satan deceiveth him. The revelation doesn't deny that the stone works, or even the possibility of receiving revelation. It just claims that Page's source is Satan, while Joseph's is God.
He neutralizes the rival by using the rival's own claimed method against him, just rebranding the non-compliant revelation as demonic.
Again, the pattern is crystal clear. When Joseph Smith faces a crisis of authority, credibility, or partnership, a revelation conveniently appears to settle the matter entirely in his favor, justifying his actions and neutralizing his rivals.
And we see this principle of self-serving convenience extending even to the seemingly mundane and personal. Let's talk about the bizarre story of the rough waters in 1831, which created a policy that persists to this day.
Joseph Smith and 10 companions were traveling by boat when they encountered really severe, frightening rough waters. The fear was real. One companion, W.W. Phelps, reportedly claimed to see the destroyer in his most horrible power ride upon the face of the waters.
A truly terrifying experience. But Joseph's reaction wasn't a broad call for faith or safety for all of humanity.
Not at all. It was an immediate self-serving decree. God cursed the waters, wherefore the days will come that no flesh shall be safe upon the waters.
And here's the leverage.
After officially cursing the water, DNC Section 61 commands Joseph Smith, along with Sidney Rigdon and Oliver Cowdery, the three key leaders, to immediately leave the water journey and travel by canal and land instead. This was a safer, premium, and far more expensive route paid for by the church.
And while the three leaders took the safe, expensive route,
the remaining eight companions were left to finish their journey on the cursed water. God explicitly showed favoritism to the prophet and his inner circle, prioritizing their comfort and fear over the safety of the rest of the group.
And the lasting, frankly ridiculous legacy of this 1831 moment of personal fear is what we see today.
The institutional prohibitions for missionaries against swimming or traveling on water without special high-level approval, a self-serving fear reaction from one leader 200 years ago, is now codified as eternal safety policy for millions of young adults.
That is the ultimate ripple effect of a bottom-up revelation. And there's one other powerful example of domestic convenience leading to massive theological change, the word of wisdom.
Right. DNC Section 89, the revelation that establishes the health code prohibiting coffee, tea, and tobacco. It's often presented as this profound, prescient health decree.
But the source material indicates the immediate catalyst was profoundly mundane.
Emma Smith's complaints. She was reportedly frustrated because the men attending the School of the Prophets, which met in her home, were chewing and spitting tobacco, common practice then, and leaving a disgusting, filthy mess on the floors and carpets.
So she reportedly said that it would be a good thing if a revelation could be had declaring the use of tobacco a sin.
And Joseph acted immediately, dictating the word of wisdom. And while it certainly aligns with the contemporary temperance movements of the day, the timing and the catalyst strongly suggest a human problem, a domestic cleanliness issue, was driving a supposed divine, everlasting solution.
The pattern is just consistent. a personal problem, a leadership crisis, or a domestic inconvenience is suddenly elevated to the status of a divine command, benefiting the prophet immediately.
And the most sophisticated form of leverage we need to analyze is how Joseph Smith continuously revised, augmented, and even inserted errors into the scriptural record to suit his evolving theological claims and his growing demands for authority.
We have to look closely at the retroactive backdating of authority. In the very earliest compilation of Revelations, the Book of Commandments, Joseph Smith promised to maintain a humble, limited role.
The original foundational revelation stated clearly that God would grant Joseph no other gift besides translating the Book of Mormon. This reinforced a limited, humble translational role for the young prophet.
But as the movement grew and he expanded his claims to prophet, seer, revelator, and ruler, this original commitment became extremely inconvenient.
Of course, because if he had no other gift, he had no justification for leading the church or receiving DNC 132 or quashing rivals like Hiram Page.
So he changed it.
Precisely. When the revelations were recompiled and published in the Doctrine and Covenants in 1835, four words were quietly inserted into that original text, changing its meaning entirely.
The new revised version stated that God would grant him no other gift.
Until it is finished.
Wow, a powerful, silent, retroactive rewrite of history.
By adding four simple words, he completely reversed the commitment. The original meaning was permanent limitation. The revised meaning was temporary suspension. Once the Book of Mormon translation was complete, the slate was clean. It allowed him to assume subsequent massive and unchecked revelatory powers.
All justified by a historical revision that was never publicly announced or discussed.
And this pattern of revision and insertion wasn't just limited to his own work. He also inserted errors into the scriptural narrative to justify his polygamy.
He needed that ancient precedent.
He did. To give DNC 132 and the principle of polygamy some ancient scriptural grounding, he needed to show that the greatest patriarchs were commanded by God to practice it.
And so DNC 132 attempts to justify the principle by claiming God commanded Abraham to take Hagar to wife, and thus Abraham was not under condemnation. This provides a necessary link. If God commands it, it is righteous.
But the biblical contradiction is immediate when you actually read Genesis closely. Genesis makes it clear that it was Abraham's wife, Sarah, who told Abraham to take Hagar because Sarah was barren.
God never commanded Abraham to enter polygamy.
Never. Joseph Smith was inserting a divine command into the ancient text that simply wasn't there, transparently trying to legitimize his own practice by falsifying scriptural history.
It speaks volumes to the urgency of the justification. He needed that ancient precedent to overcome contemporary moral objections, and he was willing to retrofit the Bible to get it.
And finally, we see linguistic errors enshrined in canonized vision accounts, errors that suggest a lack of sophisticated biblical scholarship that you would expect from a true prophet of God.
This is the Kirtland Temple vision in 1836. Joseph Smith claimed to see both Elias and Elijah appearing to deliver priesthood keys, along with Moses and others.
The problem is that Elias is simply the Greek or Hebrew name for Elijah. They are the same biblical figure.
So treating them as two distinct, separate heavenly beings who appeared sequentially.
It demonstrates a fundamental linguistic and scriptural error. It suggests he didn't understand the Bible well enough to realize they were the same person. Yet, this historical error is canonized in the Doctrine and Covenants as a sacred, historical, and theologically complex event involving two separate messengers.
And apologetic arguments have, of course, arisen to cover this mistake.
Of course. Claiming that Elias is a title for his separate forerunner figure. But this distinction only arises out of necessity to cover the mistake, rather than from established, sophisticated biblical scholarship that would recognize the linguistic equivalence immediately. These simple human fingerprints, these documented errors, confirm that Joseph Smith's understanding and thus the revelation itself was bottom-up.
We've covered extensive, difficult ground today, looking at the consistent patterns across Joseph Smith's earliest revelations. We've seen revelations used for financial gain, revelations used for psychological and sexual coercion, and revelations used strictly for damage control and personal operational convenience.
And when you stack these revelations up and view them as a response mechanism, the pattern is just overwhelming. They are not broad, eternal truths delivered from above. They are hyper-specific, time-bound solutions to the immediate, pragmatic, and often self-interested dilemmas faced by one specific leader. The evidence strongly points to a bottom-up source.
And this analysis leads us to the critical realization for you, the learner. when the prophet is designated as the sole exclusive channel for divine communication, and that communication consistently and invariably benefits that prophet.
Securing money, providing sexual partners, cementing power, solving domestic issues, neutralizing rivals.
It necessitates extreme scrutiny. The system lacks checks and balances, and the outcomes reflect the predictable abuses of power that occur when a single person can leverage the threat of eternal destruction or divine wrath to secure obedience, silence criticism, or fund a personal project.
Which brings us to a final provocative thought that builds on everything we've discussed today. The pattern we've identified is so consistent, revelation as convenience, revelation as crisis management, that apologetic scholars have sometimes used what's called the catalyst theory.
The catalyst theory.
It essentially argues that while the revelation is divine, it requires a human catalyst, a crisis, a question, or a pressing problem to draw the divine response out of God. It's an attempt to explain why God only seems to speak when Joseph Smith asks, or when Joseph Smith has a problem.
Right. But if Joseph Smith's revelations frequently function to secure his personal desires, solve his financial needs, and even contain simple biblical and linguistic errors that needed to be retroactively covered, what does this historical pattern, even viewed through the lens of the catalyst theory, reveal about the nature of modern, continuing revelation claimed by his successors today?
Is the catalyst theory simply an apologetic attempt to rationalize a long history of revelation of convenience?
We leave you with that question to ponder as you continue your own deep dive into the source material.